Thank you.
Thanks for having me here.
I didn't expect to be the first one speaking. How exciting. Anyway, this is, you can see it's already winter in Madison. Here's our paddle boat stuck in the ice. So I want to talk about a few kind of different projects that we're working on. All of them involve organic matter and organic matter transformation. And, I feel a little bit like I'm trying to cram three PhDs into a 12-minute talk, so forgive me if it seems a little bit disjointed, and please ask some questions. You know, certainly for this audience, I don't have to talk about how interesting organic carbon is, right? The organic carbon cycle is awesome. Soils and water, right, are very important in a lot of this. What I'm particularly interested in is this idea of how carbon gets transported and kind of transformed in the environment, and what kind of redox conditions drive that, what happens to microbial communities, and what happens to mineralogy kind of all along the continuum of time. And so what I want to do today is talk about a carbon transport experiment. Then I want to talk a little bit about what happens when you start introducing foreign carbon in with microbial communities. And then a tiny bit about some humic acid stuff and what happens with recalcitrant organic carbon. So we've been working out at Pacific Northwest National Lab. Frank Yang and Dinesh kind of got us in on this to begin with. And then Eric Roden and I and Steve Lohide are working on some stuff out there. But everyone knows, right, up here in Pacific Northwest, if you take a look at the Columbia River, you really see that there's a lot of organic matter, both in the river itself and then also on the sediment-water interface. And so the Columbia River, it really undergoes big changes in head. So it'll vary by 1 to 2 meters over the course of a day just due to electric power generation. And so you have a lot of pumping action where you can force organic matter into the sediments where it might be metabolized, and then, you know, when your head goes down, you can have organic carbon coming back out from the sediments and ending up back in the water. And so I'm really interested in what's happening here. So the first thing that we were looking at is kind of the super simple: does organic matter get trapped in sand, and how much? Right. It's now that I work in an environmental engineering department. All the environmental engineers, of course it does. That's why we use sand filters for all this. But we started out with some algae that we grew up from water from the Columbia River, and then just let it free flow through some Hanford Formation sand. So this is sand obtained from out at the Hanford site, and then collected what came out in the fraction collector. And so these were pretty short experiments, right? They're about a half a day. We weren't actually looking at organic matter transformation. We were more looking at, do we get organic matter retained in these columns? And we're working right now on figuring out what mechanisms are retaining this organic matter. So we could quantify what came out of the column. And then amazingly, it's much more challenging than you'd think to kind of quantify particulate organic matter in the sediment itself. And so we turned to just doing ATP extraction and looking at how much ATP was concentrated along this column. So to give you an idea, here's our, on the bottom here is volume of liquid that we've introduced. And then this is effluent concentration C over C0. So we see pretty rapid bromide breakthrough, but we see algae retained in the column, right? And then if we switch to a clean feed, so where we don't have any more algae, we see a kind of decline off and tail off. But it takes about 10 times as long for the algae to reach a steady state as the bromide. And even then, right, we're only seeing 60 to 70% of the algae coming back out. And this is actually a pretty high flow velocity, right, 2.5 meters per day. And, you know, it's reasonable within terms of the Hanford site, but pretty consistently we see retention of the algae. If we take a look at what happens with velocity variation, so this is a half meter per day, we start to see only about 30% of the algae coming back out of the column. 1.5 meters per day, we see about 60% of the algae coming out of the column. And so this POM retention is velocity dependent, right? So the amount of particulate organic matter that you retain in the column depends on how fast you put it through. And it's also going to be size dependent, right? Because it's all this transport phenomenon. Do you have gravity-driven settling? Do you have screening? Do you have impacts on the soil particles? And right now we're working on sorting out all these various retention mechanisms. But what the ATP extractions can give us, and this is distance along the column, so 0 to 20 centimeters, and then ATP mass per gram of sand, is it can give us an idea of where the biomass is retained. And I can see that my two my blue dots didn't show up here. But the slower, the 0.5 meter per day result is in the blue, and you can see that we end up with most of our ATP kind of up at the front of the column. And then the red is our faster transport rate, and we end up with biomass pretty evenly distributed throughout the column. You know, there's always a little bit extra kind of right at that first interface where you start impacting it into the material. And so the effect that this can have, and so we like I said, these were short-term experiments, so we didn't actually monitor any biotransformation of the organic matter in these systems. But we did do a few incubations that were about 20 days long, where we took this same organic matter, had some sand from the Hanford site, and inoculated it with the organic matter, and then followed what happened to organic, inorganic carbon and methane emissions. So over here are ones that were kept aerobic, so they were just mixed aerobically. Over here is where we were mixed anaerobically, and we just let it kind of cruise along, right, and then about 2 weeks we added some particulate organic matter and then followed the inorganic carbon again. And what I want to draw out in particular is that we do see a little bit increase in total inorganic carbon, but more importantly, if we take a look at the methane here, where we, right, so the black is what we added particulate organic carbon matter to, and then the not filled is just remain the same, right? So we see an increase in organic carbon. But in particular, in the anaerobic ones, we see a big spike in methane. So, you know, even though these microbial communities may not have been seeing this particulate organic matter beforehand, they still are capable of metabolizing it and releasing some additional methane into the environment. So the question then became, okay, right, indeed you can have organic matter that gets transported in, but if you think about, you know, any time you have a riverbank environment, you have a lot of distinct kind of microenvironments in this place, right? You have environments that are maybe completely controlled by groundwater chemistry. You have environments that are in the hyperreic zone where you have a lot of river groundwater exchange. And then you have environments that are solely in the river itself. And, you know, each one of these geochemical environments is going to have its own distinct microbial community. And we wanted to take a look at that and see how well microbial communities from these different environments could utilize organic matter from the other environments, right? The Columbia River, you have a lot of water sloshing back and forth, so you can have a lot of carbon moving around and transport it. So we took out, yes, these are just tea infusers full of sand. And out at PNNL, they have wells that are just drilled either into the hyperreic zone or inland from the hyperreic zone. So we could drop these tea infusers down into the well and have it in the hyperreic zone in the groundwater. Or the riverbed one, we just put some cobbles on top of this and kept it in the riverbed itself. So we did this twice, separated by about a year, and we kept these sand packs in the wells for about 6 weeks, and then after that we went through and did what we call a cross-feeding experiment. So essentially, it's taking sand that was incubated either in the riverbed, in the piezometer, so right in the hyperreic zone, or in the groundwater, and then feeding it with river water, groundwater, or artificial groundwater, and watching what happened. Just so you can see, this is groundwater sand, riverbed sand. You can see there's a tremendous amount of fines in here, right? A lot of organic carbon already in there. And then this is the sand that was incubated in the piezometer. And so you can see, even visual inspection, right, you have a lot of organic carbon in the system itself. And so what we saw pretty consistently is we measured aerobic respiration using a rhizasterin reduction to rhizopterin. And we saw similar results by quantifying ATP. But if we look at a factor of time and then metabolism, essentially, right, in all the cases, the riverbed sand, we saw the highest aerobic metabolism in here. It didn't matter, In all the cases we saw, the riverbed sand, no matter what ground, what water source we fed it, or what kind of organic carbon this water saw, we saw the most of it here. And we think in large part it's because you have this big mass of particulate organic matter that's in there and being metabolized. And so you can go across and you can take a look at the amount of dissolved organic carbon that was released from each of these sediments. And essentially what ended up happening is with the groundwater sand and the piezometer sand, we didn't see a lot of organic carbon released from the sediments. But in the case of the riverbed sand, we saw a lot of organic carbon release, especially when we fed it with water from a different source. So if we took riverbed sand and fed it with groundwater, then we really started to chow on that particulate organic matter and release some organic carbon. So I want to go on and talk about one more bit of this. And, you know, we've talked about transport. We've talked about, can it be transformed in the riverbed sediments? How is it impacting organic carbon cycling? We have another student of mine is looking at how redox cycling impacts this mineral reactivity and working with Frank Yang and company. But what I want to just briefly address is, can recalcitrant organic matter serve as an electron donor as well? And so this is a slightly different experiment. We're changing systems here. We're not in Hanford sand anymore. But this is hematite-coated sand, or I'm sorry, just hematite, along with humic acids and then a little bit of glucose. And essentially, right, if you have plus HA and plus glucose, that means humic acids and glucose. If you have plus HA and minus glucose, right, we'll kind of walk it through and uninoculate it. And so what you see each time, right, is that if we have humic acids and glucose, we see the highest amount of iron 2 generated. So we're reducing that hematite and generating iron 2. Humic acids alone, we actually see an increase as well. And so not only are these humic acids being metabolized, but they also have a role to play in increasing electron transfer from the microbial community on in. And this was, I'm sorry, I didn't say where this was inoculated, from Eric Roden's backyard. He has a tremendous culture of iron-reducing bacteria in his backyard. I figure it's just contamination from 30 years of working with iron reducers. We always give them a tough time about it. So what we really wanted to see with this is we wanted to take a look at microbial metabolic potential. So are these microbes actually expressing genes that can transform complex carbohydrates into more simple organic acids? Fortunately, I have a very, very talented graduate student, Jackie Mejia, who is graduating this winter and looking for a postdoc, but she did all this all the way down to here to genes and functions, and she said, don't try and explain that, Matt, you'll just mess it up. So anyway, DNA sequencing, it's astonishing what you can do now. Oh, no, I hadn't done it for 20 years. So, I mean, really, right? It's, you know, tens of thousands of reads, rebuilding it in all sorts of different ways, going back through and looking at genomic potential. And so what we did after we got a lot of sequences from these things is we went through, and we took a look for actual enzymes involved in complex organic carbon degradation. So carbohydrate, esterases, some, you know, auxiliary activity, glycoside, hydrolases, and went through and looked at the differential expression in the various systems. And so you can see that in the presence of humic acid, right, so anytime we're adding humic acid, we see a real overrepresentation of genes involved in complex organic carbon degradation. And so that's awesome, right? What we've shown, you can introduce particulate organic matter. If you have some more recalcitrant organic matter in these systems, they'll start to degrade, and you can see some upticks in the microbial community. So overall, you can have a lot of complex things going on. You can have organic matter being transported, transformed, and moved around, and it's really actually turned out to be a pretty fun system to work in. So this work, largely Noah Stern and then Jackie Mejia did this work, and then also I worked with Eric Roden, Steve Lohide. And DOE provided the funding. I'm happy to take any questions if there's time. I think I have a minute, 2 minutes maybe. All right.
If time for one or two questions.
Aaron's always good for a question.
I know. So in the when you change, you mentioned you change the water composition that drives the release of carbon. Why is that? Do you change the ion strength, or is it changing the? What do you think's going on that's driving the?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think sometimes the artificial river water and the groundwater have some smaller organic acids in there, and we think it might be a little bit of priming effect, right, where you get a little bit of more easily degradable organics in there, and then they can go to town on the more complex things once the community gets going. There's a lot going on in the system. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Jackie. Yeah.
Is the glucose not so favorable for the particular microbial community, or is the glucose providing other nutrients?
The glucose mostly gets fermented, and then you have a bunch of other organics around. So I don't know how much the microbes are directly using the glucose. I think this humic acid, so this was isolated from a real soil, and so I think there's probably some extra in there as well with the humic acids. Thanks for the question. All right, I better run away here.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you. I'll be around later.